Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
That scene, those words, still elicit chills. Even now, more than 80 years after they first echoed from the infield of Yankee Stadium. Today, finally, Gehrig's fight against ALS, aka Lou Gehrig's disease, is being recognized by MLB like never before. And Jeff Passan brings us the story of the man who made it his personal mission to make Lou Gehrig Day a reality. A mission that even this terrible illness couldn't stop. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, June 2nd. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Jeff Passan, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, Pablo.
So today is a special day in Major League Baseball, Jeff. This is a sport that has league-wide celebrations for Jackie Robinson and Roberto Clemente, and now it adds Lou Gehrig to that extremely selective list. And you have this incredible story you've reported on how all of this came to pass behind the scenes. But before we even get there, because Gehrig is remembered for so much beyond the game, I was wondering if you could just remind us who Lou Gehrig was as a ballplayer.
If Babe Ruth hadn't existed, Lou Gehrig would have been Babe Ruth. He was your imposing, incredible, left-handed, slugging New York Yankee. A guy who was mashing 40 home runs a year and driving in easily 150 runs and batting in the 370s and doing all of this with grace and class and intelligence and just this savoir-faire that kind of was in contrast to who Babe Ruth was. Babe Ruth was the man about town, the drinker. Lou Gehrig was kind of his classy counterpoint and somebody who is looked back upon not just how he lived, but because of how he died with great reverence.
Yeah, the end of Gehrig's life, Jeff, is what everybody tends to think about when they think about the man. The way his career and his life were cut short by a disease which had simply been known as Lou Gehrig's disease for so long, is now known as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known now as just ALS. So remind us, Jeff, what is ALS and when did it strike Lou Gehrig?
ALS is a progressive neurodegenerative disease that essentially takes a person's muscles and withers them down to the point where he and she loses the ability to move. And it renders a person a prisoner in his or her own body. When you have ALS, your mind is the one thing that does not atrophy. You lose the ability to swallow, so you can't eat anymore. You lose the ability to walk. You lose the ability to speak. And depending on the severity, this can happen over a course of 5 or 10 years, and this can happen in a matter of months.
So in 1939, Jeff, Lou Gehrig has been one of the greatest players on maybe the greatest team ever. But at age 36, he receives this diagnosis. What was it looking like up until that point? How did he know something had been going on with his body?
You know, in the 11 years before the 1938 season, Pablo, Lou Gehrig's average batting average was 350. His average OPS was 1117. We're talking about an elite of the elite player. So even though he comes out in 1938 and bats 295 and slugs 523, he could tell something was a little bit wrong. He felt tired. And when spring training came around in 1939, it was clear something was wrong. His power was gone. His batting average dropped perilously during the regular season. And after eight games, when he was hitting 143, Lou Gehrig, this man who had done the unthinkable, playing in 2,130 consecutive games, benched himself. And he never played another baseball game again.
Jeff, what happens on July 4th, 1939?
Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day at Yankee Stadium. It's one of those days where when somebody is honored, you're not exactly sure what it's going to look like. Is it going to be sad? Is it going to be poignant? Is somebody who understands that his fate is decided going to just stand there and say thank you and walk away, and that will be that? Instead, we were given Pablo the most important speech in sports history.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
And I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that, because still, all these decades later, I think any sports fan knows the sound and the echo of the microphone when Lou Gehrig is speaking.
When you look around, wouldn't you consider it a privilege to associate yourself with such a fine-looking man as is standing in uniform in this ballpark today?
The words, the way that he delivers them, and the fact that somebody who knows he's dying can still say those words, I think has inspired generations.
That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
So ALS has this distinct legacy within baseball directly because of Gehrig, Jeff. But I know it also doesn't come close to stopping with him, because we saw a surge in ALS awareness nationally thanks to that world-famous Ice Bucket Challenge that was created by Pat Quinn and Pete Frates. Pete, a baseball player at Boston College, that was all several years ago. And I also know our colleague Boog Shiambi, who's talked about Pat and Pete on the show before, has used his platform in baseball as an announcer to raise money and awareness for ALS. But for so long, despite all that history and more, there wasn't an official league-wide coordinated effort to fight this disease until a guy named Brian Wayne Gallantine got involved. So Jeff, who was Brian Wayne Gallantine?
Brian Wayne Gallantine was a force of nature.
Hey, B. Wayne. In the house.
He was a songwriter of country music, so his job was to tell stories, Pablo. And the story that he was able to tell about why Major League Baseball needs to have a Lou Gehrig Day is one that's going to live on for a really long time.
What was his relationship with baseball like, Jeff?
He loved baseball.
I live, eat, breathe baseball. Always have, always will.
And the poor guy was an Orioles fan, so it had been a rough couple of years for him. He played in high school in Virginia. He played in college. You know, he always talked about how he would have been a big leaguer, but he got hurt. And there are plenty of those people out there, but that didn't end his love of the game. He would travel around the country wanting to go to all 30 stadiums. You know, he was a guy who loved bucket lists, and baseball was always part of them. He wanted to see games. He wanted to be part of them. He loved baseball more than any sport out there.
How does ALS enter the equation for him?
Back in 2017, he had been feeling some tingling in his hands, and he thought maybe it's carpal tunnel, you know, had a couple of surgeries. They were trying to figure out what exactly was causing this. And one day just doubles over.
Really bad cramping and twitching. Starting to lose my voice and trouble swallowing and stuff like that.
And his wife, Stacy, is like, all right, we got to figure this out.
I was actually here one evening and he doubled over in pain. And of course, my initial thought was, you know, heart. And, you know, so it was like, get in the car, we're going to go to the ER. And he said, well, I've actually had this happen a couple times and I'm not sure what it is, but let's, you know, we'll start to get it figured out. And what that was that cramping of the muscles, you know, essentially just doubling him over.
They see a neurologist and they're given, and I say they, Pablo, because ALS is the sort of disease that while it literally affects one person, it upends lives. It's not just a disease that affected Brian. It affected Stacy. It affected Grayson and Bennett, their sons. It affected a community in the Nashville area of people who love him. It's the sort of thing that turns your life upside down and you have absolutely no idea what you're going to do, because he was told you have between 2 and 5 years to live.
That's the one that I think hit the hardest, was just trying to wrap our heads around what does 2 to 5 years look like? And, you know, we have these two little boys. What's that going to look like for them?
Brian Wayne Gallantine's answer to that was, I'm going to live. And I'm going to live as much as I can and do as many things as I can.
I didn't want this diagnosis, but in a weird way, I'm okay with it because I have, you know, a bigger purpose now.
One day, Stacy comes home and everyone calls Brian B. Wayne. B. Wayne's there and he's got like 2 dozen cracked eggs. And Stacy's like, what are you doing? And he says, I wanted to learn to make the perfect omelet. And that became a motto of his, what's your omelet? And what he meant by that is, what do you want to do? What do you want to make this day? How do you want to grow as a person? So Brian figures out his omelet, but he's not done, because an idea pops into his head, Pablo, and on June 24th, 2019, he sends a text message that literally changes the course of baseball.
All right, Jeff, after the break, how Brian Wayne Gallantine finds his purpose in this diagnosis and how it changes baseball.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
All All right, Jeff. So in 2017, Brian B. Wayne Gallantine is given the worst diagnosis imaginable, ALS. It is a disease with no cure. He has a wife. He has two young kids. So what does he decide to do about it?
Baseball is still at the forefront of his mind now because, remember, he understands he doesn't have a whole lot of time to live, so he's going to focus on the things that really do matter to him, on his wife and on his kids and on this game that confuses him a little bit. Because just once before Pablo, back in 2009, there was a man named Michael Goldsmith. He was a lawyer and an ALS advocate, and he convinced Bud Selig, the commissioner at the time, to honor Lou Gehrig on July 4th that year. And at 15 stadiums across the country, they did just that. It didn't happen in 2010 and 2011 and beyond. It was a one-year thing. And Brian Wayne Gallantine saw that and thought to himself, how can Major League Baseball not honor Lou Gehrig? It doesn't make any sense. And so he sent a text message to his friends Adam Wilson, who has ALS, and Chuck Haberstroh, whose mother Patty has ALS.
He sent a text saying basically, like, why isn't there like a Lou Gehrig Day like Jackie Robinson Day? And we said, so that's an interesting idea, B. Wayne. You know, like, seems like a big ask, but let's try to do it.
This was such a classic B. Wayne thing to do. He's the guy who says, hey guys, why don't we just go tell Major League Baseball to have a Lou Gehrig Day? Let's try and do something that nobody else has done that is wrapped like a mummy in red tape that has such little chance to actually come to fruition, because who's going to stop us from doing it?
What did Lou Gehrig mean to B. Wayne personally?
He was inspiration. He was someone who lived the right way, and he was someone who died the right way. And a lot of times with ALS patients, what they want is dignity in a disease that tries to rob it. And I think B. Wayne saw how Lou Gehrig died and said to himself, if I'm going to go, I want to go the same way. I want to go spending time with the people that I love and doing the kinds of things that I believe are going to have a long-lasting impact.
So how does B. Wayne start this particular mission, the mission of establishing a Lou Gehrig Day?
You know, it started with the text message, and Adam Wilson and Chuck Haberstroh were like, well, all right, B. Wayne, let's get at it. The Colorado Rockies are the first team on board because their first baseman, Sam Hilliard's father, Jim, was diagnosed with ALS. So he's in. And then the Oakland A's are in because their outfielder, Stephen Piscotty's mother, Gretchen, was diagnosed with ALS. They get to eight teams and it stalls. And B. Wayne does not take kindly to this stalling.
He wouldn't take no for an answer. He said, it's going to be easy. When they hear our story, they're going to have to say yes.
Quite honestly, there were days when I would be frustrated because we're at the dinner table and he's on an ALS call talking about Lou Gehrig Day.
B. Wayne was mystified when they were standing there with eight teams saying, how are all 30 teams not jumping at doing this?
So they've hit this wall. They have just eight of the 30 teams on board. How do they get from there to a place where the whole entire league buys into this idea?
A stroke of luck. It was October of 2020, and they were desperate. B. Wayne had gone from not being able to walk, to not being able to talk, to being on a ventilator for 23 hours a day. And people who have ALS like to say we work at the speed of ALS, which means there's no time to wait around for anything. And the desperation got to the point where Adam Wilson started guessing email addresses. He went and looked at an organization's domain, and he guessed, okay, is it first initial last name? Is it first name dot last name? And when he tried to email a man named Derek Hall, who's the president of the Arizona Diamondbacks, what he didn't realize was just how fortuitous that email was going to be. Derek Hall had lost a friend to ALS and had lost his grandfather to ALS. And so immediately, Derek Hall's first thought was, why isn't this done?
I got so excited when I saw Lou Gehrig in the email that I immediately wrote back and said, guys, let's do this. Let's figure out how to get this done. Count me in.
And so he talked with Dave St. Peter, the Minnesota Twins president, and Sam Kennedy, the Boston Red Sox president. And together, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on October 19th, they sent out an email to executives around baseball looking for their support in creating this Lou Gehrig Day. Derek Hall sends out the email. 5 minutes later, Randy Levine from the New York Yankees writes back, I support it. And then the Dodgers come in, and Stan Kasten says, the Dodgers and I are on board. And then Derek Jeter, who owns the Miami Marlins, comes in and says, you have my support and that of the Marlins. And the emails just keep rolling in. Finding consensus in baseball, Pablo, is an impossibility. You could ask the 30 baseball teams, what does 1 + 1 equal? And one of them would be like, nah, it's 3. Like, you can't get all 30 baseball teams on the same page with anything. And within 24 hours, all 30 Major League Baseball teams had agreed that Lou Gehrig Day had to become a reality, had to be a part of this sport's present and a bigger part of this sport's future.
So on October 21st of 2020, it is decided by the league officially. Lou Gehrig Day will take place on June 2nd every single year from this day forward, June 2nd being the day when Gehrig began his consecutive game streak and also the day he died. So every Lou Gehrig's Day from now on, each home club is going to display 4 ALS logos on their jerseys commemorating Gehrig's uniform number 4. There's going to be commemorative patches and wristbands and participation from the ALS community with first pitches and national anthems across the sport, which is exactly what B. Wayne had worked for, Jeff. So where was he when he heard the news that Lou Gehrig Day was going to be a reality?
B. Wayne was at his house, and, you know, Stacy says he just had this energy about him.
Brian was at that point pretty much on a ventilator, almost 24 hours a day. We were sitting in this very room that I'm in now, and I remember him saying, we did it.
He was so excited about this, you know. He was going to live to see this day happen. And it's about somebody who he never met, and it's for people who he may never meet. And he still did it. Seeing that all the way to the end, seeing that through, and seeing it happen, I think brought Brian Wayne Gallentine the sort of peace that all of us are looking for in our lives.
What happens the next day?
Stacy, that morning, she's a fundraiser for a college, and she had gone to Nashville to have a meeting, and she got a call from B. Wayne's caregiver.
I left to go to Nashville that morning, just like you know, any other day. And I sat down and was a little bit early for the meeting and got a call from his caregiver, just that he wasn't breathing.
So she gets on the highway, drives as fast as she possibly can. And the cruelty of this is that they had another thing to look forward to. And he would never get to see that. His heart stopped, and he passed away that morning. But he did so, I think, fulfilled. And I don't, you know, I hate assigning this idea of everything ending perfectly, like he had accomplished what he'd wanted to and now he could go peacefully.
Mm.
But I believe there's some truth in that. The day before Pablo, he had spent it with Grayson and Bennett looking through his old baseball cards and talking with them about these players that they didn't know about, but who meant everything to him, because this game, this sport, this was his.
So here we are today, Jeff. It is June 2nd. It is the first ever Lou Gehrig Day. And so how is Brian's family? How is Stacy and Grayson and Bennett? How are they going to celebrate? What are they going to do on this day?
They're in Baltimore. And they're going to be throwing out the first pitch at the Orioles game today. And the fact that they get to be there in his park with his team on a day that exists because of him, it's beautiful. The hope, the desire for everybody involved here is that when the next Brian Wayne Gallentine gets diagnosed with ALS, that he's not going to be given 2 to 5 years to live, that he's going to be told because of the efforts and because of the research and because of people like him, the next generation can look at ALS as something that's terrible but manageable. And these lives that they live, knowing what the inevitable conclusion's going to be, is no longer inevitable.
Jeff Pazin, thank you for telling us the story of Brian and this entire community on ESPN Daily.
Thanks, Pablo.
Coming up, we go from the most important speech in sports history to one that speaks directly to the moment that Naomi Osaka finds herself in right now.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. Naomi Osaka's withdrawal from the French Open reminded me of a different inflection point in sports history, one that also took place in Paris, some 111 years before. Because in spring 1910, not far from Roland Garros, Teddy Roosevelt gave the speech that would forever be known as the Man in the Arena, a sort of athlete's creed that would be quoted and memorialized by everyone from LeBron James to Tom Brady to the late John McCain, who who knew the words by heart. "It is not the critic who counts," President Roosevelt began.
"Credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat."
Now, as one of those souls, as a non-athlete spectator and journalist, I do have to admit that TR kinda has a point. There are too many critics who underrate the vulnerability of the men and women in these arenas. There are too many maniacs in the stands launching popcorn at Russell Westbrook, or trash at Kyrie Irving, or spit at Trae Young. There are too many reporters and tournament officials, for that matter, who are numb to an athlete's need to see her mental health as simply health, even if it means skipping press conferences and being fined for it, and then withdrawing altogether. So I get why big picture questions are now being asked about why athletes like Osaka should even be required, for instance, to grant interviews to the working press at all. But that is where my cold and timid soul starts getting a little hot and bothered. Because even outside of the brass tacks answer to that question, which hinges on billion-dollar TV contracts and who needs whose money and attention, there is an even bigger picture question broached here about what we want the future of sports itself to be. Because, yes, mental health is self-evidently critical, but there can still be fair criticism. And yes, empathy is absolutely essential, but there can still be hard questions. And yes, decency, that should be a prerequisite, but there can still be tens of thousands of fans who are booing, and there can still be pressure. Now, all of this does require a very delicate balance between humanity and harshness. And just this week, I've seen many well-meaning people point out that, well, athletes aren't allowed to just show up and criticize fans at their workplaces. But we also don't sell tickets to those workplaces. And frankly, we don't care about those workplaces. The best painters or plumbers or podcasters on this planet will never get a single championship parade. And to be clear, we shouldn't. Because as Teddy Roosevelt himself once explained, an arena is not just some other office. It's a place defined by people and dust and sweat and blood and victory and sometimes defeat. And somewhere in that delicate balance is the magic of what sports ought to be. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.